Tonight we're dealing with the patriarch Aaron, and that's part 5 in our basic Bible study series. Any parents will admit that controlling children is a difficult and uncertain task. Psychologist Henry Brandt tells a story of the time that he and his wife invited the president of the college he was attending along to their house for dinner. They were nervous. They had spent considerable time preparing the house and the meal, and they were very determined here that they would make a good impression with the college president. When the president arrived, they stumbled over themselves just to make him feel comfortable. So they decided the best thing we can do is sit him down next to our 2-year-old daughter for the meal, and she in her rather engaging way will really win him over to us. This was a mistake. During the meal, the little tot said to the president in a kind of a bird-like voice, "Please pass the salt." No one paid any attention to that little voice. They were all listening to the president. So the little girl tried again, "Will you please pass the salt?" That small voice, once more, was easy to ignore. The adults were straining, listening to the president's every word. Finally, she hammered that distinguished guest on the arm and she yelled, "Pass the salt, or I'll knock your block off." Even a president of not a college, but the United States of America itself, was rather nonplussed by the antics of his child. Alice Roosevelt, daughter of Theodore Roosevelt, was an unruly girl, and her antics scandalized the rather staid Washington society during the time that her father was in the White House. When a visitor objected to the girl's wandering in and out of the president's office while he was conducting important affairs, Roosevelt said, "I can be president of the United States, or I can control Alice. I cannot possibly do both." The patriarch Aaron was a time of godly men presiding over a growing family. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, successive generations, they were of the same family, ruled over the Hebrew people in the earliest days of their existence. On more than one occasion, I'm sure Abraham must have felt rather like Brandt and Roosevelt, because as he looked at his descendants, he saw that they weren't all behaving in the way that he wanted them to. Passion for God Abraham had. He wanted to do what God wanted him to do in the world. And so, God's plan for the Hebrew people burned like a flame in the heart of Abraham. But that flame would have flickered and would have dimmed in successive generations. However, the time of slavery, whenever that came, and the Hebrew people were put down into the land of Egypt, it sharpened the spiritual hunger of those Hebrew people, and the great family in the days of Abraham, which over time became a great nation, emerged out of the ashes of Egypt. Now we have a review here under the little shepherd-like figure. That's the patriarch holding his staff. The Ark of Bible History, number 2, the patriarch Aaron. We have a review there, and we're asking fill in the blanks to bring the chart up to date with this Aaron. First Aaron. Well, that was last week, and we covered the creation era, so that's the word that was in there, the figure. Adam was a prominent figure in the creation era. The location was, of course, the Garden of Eden, and the storyline summary filling in the blanks reads like this: Adam is created by God, but he sins and destroys God's original plan for man. Now we come to era number 2 tonight, which we've said already is the patriarch Aaron. The main figure, rising head and shoulders above the rest, is Abraham. The location is the land of Canaan. And we're going to give you the storyline summary there at the bottom of page 2 in the notes. The storyline summary is Abraham is chosen by God to father a people to represent God to the world. So that really is our theme tonight. Abraham, chosen by God to father a people to represent God to the world. When we get into the storyline expansion, top of page 3, we find there are 4 major men in the patriarch Aaron, and we want to scan through their careers here tonight. First man, Abraham, of course. Second, Isaac. Third, Jacob. And the fourth is Joseph. So we're coming down to business here with Abraham, who is the father of the Hebrew people. We begin to read about him in Genesis chapter 11, the verse 10, and we're still reading about Abraham when we come into Genesis chapter 25 and the verse 18. Because of Adam's sin in the Garden of Eden, therefore man's fall, God is revealing to his people a plan of redemption. Of course, that he had decided upon in eternity past, but now that that plan is needed visibly before them, God is beginning to bring the details of that plan of redemption out. He wants a people through whom he can work to produce a reflection of himself upon the earth. He wants a people through whom he can spread the message of redemption unto the world. And so in the days of Paul, we have Paul saying in the book of Romans about the Jews, the oracles of God belonged unto them. God revealed himself specifically to the Jews. He wants a people, you see, now in the days of Abraham, through whom he can spread the message of redemption unto the world. Back here in the patriarch era, he chooses Abraham. Abraham becomes the father of the Hebrew people. He promises to Abraham a country, a land. He promised to them countless descendants, that is a seed, a people. And he also promises a worldwide and a timeless impact that will be the blessing upon Abraham. Now when this first occurs, Abraham is living in Ur. That's near where the river Tigris and the great river Euphrates come together, where they converge. God leads them from Ur through Haran to the land of Canaan, and Abraham settles there, and he has two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. So that's the overall summary, the bird's eye view, if you like, of Abraham's life. Let's get into the specifics about Abraham. There were three crises in Abraham's life that help us, these three crises, to analyze his story. First of all, we have the call, then we have the covenant, and then, as you'll see in the notes there, we have, thirdly, the cross. So first major crisis in the life of Abraham was his call. And we read about that in Genesis 11, verse 10, through to Genesis 14 and the verse 24. It's obvious when we start reading in the Bible about Abraham that we are dealing here with a chosen man. And you can work that out rather quickly from Genesis chapter 10. By a process of elimination there, Ham and Japheth, two of the sons of Noah, are mentioned and then they're left. Chapter 10, verse 1, verse 6, verse 21, Ham and Japheth, they come to the surface and then they kind of sink like stones. And that leaves us free to consider the family tree and line of Noah's son, the line of Shem. The descendants of Shem, the Semitic race, appear to have settled in North Assyria on the borders of Armenia. Some of those Semites, including Tiram, the father of Abraham, migrated south to a large city at the time called Ur of the Chaldees. There Tiram became the father of three sons, Haran, Nahor, and Abraham, and we're told about that in Genesis 11 and the verse 26. Archaeology. Those guys get into the dust and begin digging. They have shown us that in the 3rd millennium BC, Ur would have been a thriving metropolis. It was one of the richest, one of those powerful cities of Mesopotamia, and for a time, Ur would have been the capital, ruling over the whole of Babylon. So we come to Ur, and we have a place of great civilization, and a place of tremendous learning as well. The inhabitants, we're told, were of a fairly peaceful disposition. They devoted themselves to such subjects as science and art. Seemed to be like an ancient form of what later developed in and around the Greek city of Athens. But while they were given to science, while they were given to art and philosophy and all the rest of it, they were, however, idolaters. They worshipped down there in Ur the celestial bodies, chiefly the moon. It would seem the city took its name from the moon, as their moon god was called Hurkai. And so Ur came from the middle of that name. Now, a decisive factor in the importance and greatness of the city was its location, on the banks of the river Euphrates. And that river Euphrates was navigable for sea-going ships as far up as Ur. So the foundation for the prosperity of Ayr would have been in foreign trade brought in by these ships, and the city appears to have reached its peak of prosperity between 3000 and 1600 BC. Now, that information is valuable. What does it do? How is it valuable? Well, it shows us that Abraham, growing up in this influential city, was not an uncultured individual. He was not, in other words, a backwoods boy. He was not a desert nomad. He was a highly cultured, sophisticated man, an inhabitant of one of the largest centers of civilization in the world as it was then known. Those Semites, of which he was one, who migrated from the north down to where? Maybe for pastoral purposes around the city. They were not immune, however, from the heathen practices around them. And so Abram's family, very quickly, they became idolaters. Joshua tells us in Joshua 24, verses 2 and 15, that even Terah, the father of Abraham, worshipped idols. It's rather surprising to think that Abraham was brought up in the middle of this kind of surrounding, that he was subjected through those impressionable days of his childhood to this kind of training. It's even more surprising when you read through the Bible record about Abraham that you don't find a single trace that would lead you to the conclusion that Abraham followed in the ways of his father and became like him, an idolater. We are not told that in the Word of God. Abraham, then, was a chosen man. His was a planned life. No life, we say, is by chance, by accident, without purpose. This fact becomes particularly clear as we follow in the footsteps of Abraham. We find a man whose steps are truly ordered by the Lord. God called him out of Ur, number one, giving him no promise at that particular time, as we read off in Acts 7:2-4. Then secondly, God called him out of Haran, giving him rich promise on this occasion, Genesis 12:1-5. Thirdly, God separated him from Lot, and promised Abraham the land of Canaan, Genesis chapter 13. The fourth step in the footsteps of Abraham, God promised a son, Isaac, to continue his name through the generations, Genesis 15. Then the fifth step, God gave him a token, gave him a sign, gave him a proof of the certainty of the promise in Genesis chapter 17. The sixth step in the footsteps of Abraham, God confirmed to Sarah the promise of a son in Genesis 18. Then God fulfilled his design in the gift of Isaac, who was the promised seed, and we read of him in Genesis chapter 21. Eight steps in the life of Abraham, God brought Abraham to Mount Moriah so that Abraham could hand back the seed, the promise, Isaac, unto the giver God. And that we read of in Genesis chapter 22. And this was the supreme goal that everything else was aiming towards. And though when Abraham gets to the Mount Moriah, it must have appeared like midnight to his mind, it was really midday in the estimate and in the plan of Jehovah. All along through his life, through these many footsteps, the divine hand had been at work, leading Abraham, working in his life on a beautiful piece of tapestry. So we have in Abraham a chosen man, we have a planned life, and we have as well a divine call that is issued in Abraham's experience. Notice first of all about this call, the command in this call. The first call came to Abraham when he was down in Ur, down at the convergence of the Tigris and Euphrates River in this exceedingly prosperous metropolis of Ur. Genesis 11, verse 27-32, and Acts 7:2-4, confirms what we have read in the book of Genesis. Abraham, Terah his father, Lot, and the woman, having got the call of God, set out for the land of Canaan. Now, being a pastoral tribe and having a multitude of cattle coming along with them, naturally, they were going to look for a country that would be suitable for their requirements. And they find this when they travelled north at Haran. That was 300 miles north of where they'd been coming from, the city of Ur. Haran, we have a number of notes about it here. It was a wealthy trading town back then. It was located on the main passage between Nineveh and Damascus. Genesis 12 and verse 5 makes it plain that Abraham and his relatives had enjoyed a fair degree of prosperity during the time that they were resident in this town, that their flocks and herds had really built up. And so having spent some time in Haran, whenever they would next move, they would move as very prosperous people indeed. When they were at Haran, Terah, Abraham's father, died. And it appears that around this time, Nahor, Abraham's surviving brother, also moved up to Haran and made it his headquarters. When Nahor shifted his house, changed dwelling, he didn't leave his sins behind. He brought all of those old idols with him up from Ur to Haran. Then the call of God came again to Abraham, second time around. Another call. This time, the call is more distinct. And we read about this one in Genesis 12, verses 1 to 5. In fact, we're told that this call was fourfold. A, get thee out of thy country. B, and from thy kindred. C, and from thy father's house. D, unto a land that I will show thee. So what Abraham had to leave was well defined. Leave your country, leave your kindred, leave your father's house. All of that detail is given. What he was told to go to was pretty much undefined. For God says, where you're going is just a land that I will show you. So he doesn't tell him the specific land that he's going to. No wonder Hebrews 11 verse 8 puts it like this. By faith Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whither he went. This is God's way of testing faith. And there is wisdom and gentleness and encouragement all wrapped up as components of this call. God does not go immediately to the painful heart of the issue, leaving your father's house, but gently he prepares Abraham for this by loosing him first from his country, get thee out of thy country, then from his kindred, and from thy kindred, and then only then, ultimately, from the father's house. And he gives him encouragements all along the way to do this. So we have therefore the command in this call. Then we have, secondly, the promise attached to this call. The promise attached to this call. God had given him a fourfold command. And corresponding with every part of that fourfold command, God gave Abraham a fourfold promise. I will bless thee. A message for the individual. I will make thy name great. A message for the family. I will make of thee a great nation. A message for the nation. In thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. A message for the race. Notice here the clear correspondence. How God caters for our needs and our fears at every point and turn. So we have therefore a call that was given unto Abraham and a command in the call. We have the promise attached to every particular in the call. And then we have thirdly the response to this call. It gladdens my heart to read that Abraham reacted to the call and to the promise of God with implicit obedience. So we read Genesis 12 verse 4. So Abraham departed as the Lord had spoken unto him. We're not told about his complaints. We're not told about any questions, even if he did have them. We're not told about them. We're only told about his act. He departed as the Lord had spoken unto him. Notice as well here how Abraham's leaving of Haran is emphasized in a variety of ways in Genesis 12 that indicates how real and how thorough this act of his obedience was. Verse 4, for example, we're told he departed. Verse 5, he went forth. Verse 6, he passed through. Verse 8, he removed. Verse 9, he journeyed. Real, thorough obedience is in view here. That's why we call it implicit obedience. But he also responded to this call with great faith. He went out alone for God and alone with God. Hebrews 11 verses 8 and 9 confirms that. Now if he had been taking consultations with those around him, in either the big sprawling city of Ur to begin with, the capital of that region, or indeed taking soundings when he was up in Haran and doing exceptionally well and knowing prosperity on every side, if he'd gone down to the street corner and said to a bunch of his mates, "Now, what do you think of this? God has told me to move on. I don't know where I'm going. He says it's going to be a land that I will show you." Didn't tell me where. Told me, "Get out of my country, out of from my kindred, out from my father's house. Make this big, colossal change in your life. This wonderful step." Had he discussed that with the friends on the street corner, he would have appeared absolutely foolish in the eyes of the world. "I'm setting off with my caravan for an unknown land." According to the judgment of the world, he'd have been a fool. But from God's standpoint, in listening to his command, in taking the promise attached to this call, in responding with obedience to this call, in God's eyes, he attained to the dignity of being God's friend. And he became the greatest example of faith in God that history has turned up for us. So he responds to the call with implicit obedience, with great faith, and in tremendous devotion. Abraham was sent to the land of Canaan to be a witness to the truth. There is one God. The truth of monotheism, as he termed it in theology. And he was going to a people who didn't believe in one God, who were not monotheistic, in other words, but they were polytheistic. They had a God here, a God there, a God somewhere else. They were worshipping a whole raft of gods. And Abraham goes in to be a witness to the one true God, Jehovah, unto these idolatrous people. Passing through Damascus, through Shechem, the Lord appeared to him between Bethel and Ai, and Abraham built an altar there. Actually, the spiritual history of Abraham can be traced by the altars that he raised, or even by the altars he failed to raise. There was, for example, no record of an altar being built when Abraham sinned and went down into Egypt. Each step of real advance for us in the life of faith will involve an altar on which some dear fragment of the selfish life within us is offered up. Or it will involve a burying place in which some cherished idol will be buried. So we have a call, the promise attached to the call, the response given to the call. And then fourthly, we have a sad departure from this call. A famine in Canaan sparks off a loss of faith in Abraham. And when the famine breaks out, he goes down to Egypt for help. And we trace here seven steps in his declension. Number one, what did he do? He acted without consulting God. Always a seriously foolish thing to do. Verse 10, we read of that. Then he plotted his own course. Then he resorted to duplicity in order to carry out his plan. In verse 13, he said that Sarah was his sister, which according to the frequent use of the word in the Old Testament would have been technically true, but in actual fact, Sarah was his niece. But his intention was to deceive here, and he has to be judged on the basis of his intention. Remember always that half the truth is always the blackest lie. Then another step in declension, number four, he allowed Egypt to eclipse God from his sight. Verses 2 and verse 12. God had said one thing. Abraham thinks another. Abraham, oh, he trusted God with his whole life, but he failed to trust God with this one circumstance in his life. Then the fifth step, his worldly plan succeeded. Verses 14 and 15. The man who walks away from God, the woman who departs from God and from his plan and from his will, does not always hit a solid brick wall immediately. Their plan can work. God can allow it to work for a while. And so Abraham's worldly plan succeeded in verses 14 and 15. His life was saved and Sarah was taken into the royal court. But then he became increasingly bogged down in his own deceitful scheme in verse 16. And he was given a lecture on how to live properly by an idolatrous king and sent out of the country. If he was a dog, he'd go with his tail between his legs. He was suitably chastened on this occasion, verses 18 and 20. So we come, number 5, to a new start on the call. Left Egypt a chastened, but a wiser man. And you'll see that he goes back to the beginning. Abraham learned, you see, that progress in the life of faith will come to a standstill as soon as you veer off the course of God's will. Outwardly, things look as if they're going very well. Outwardly, things can still travel along quite smoothly. But really, really and actually, communion with God is shattered, and the life of faith comes to a standstill when you veer off from the will of God. God did not reveal himself to Abraham while he was down in Egypt, and that's why Abraham did not build any altars down there. Vision, he didn't have any here. Worship, he didn't engage in it here. They're excluded by his disobedience. The voice of God cannot fall on closed ears, neither can an unbelieving heart pray. And so Abraham's time in Egypt was typical of the experience of a saved soul and a lost life. Now he discovered that blessing begins again, exactly where you left off previous blessing. Genesis 13, 1-4, and Abram went up out of Egypt, even to, listen to where he goes, even to Bethel, on to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, on to the place of the altar, which he had made there at the first, and there Abram called on the name of the Lord. He's back on track. Only when he gets back to the beginning, back to the place of the last altar, back over the way of sin, retrace the steps to the place of cleansing again, back to the place of prayer. This was the path that restored Abraham back into fellowship with God again. And having got back on track, Abraham steps forward into freedom. Genesis 13 describes the strife, the battle, the conflict between the herdsmen of Abraham and Lot. Tells us about the separation of the ways between Abraham and Lot. You go this way, I'll go that way. Whatever way you choose to go, I'll go in the opposite direction. That was the arrangement they came to. And Lot decides on the basis of sight. He chooses by sight. Abraham chooses by faith. Lot takes to the plains. Abraham gets up into the hills. One of them, Lot, looked for ease and looked for luxury. The other was prepared to climb and prepared to suffer. On way to the ultimate goal. And as Abraham travels on the path of obedience, apparent loss to others is actual gain for him. He lost a part, he lost Sodom, but he got the whole. He got north, he got south, he got east, he got west in the land, the whole country. Each step taken with God proves a step into a fuller, further life. In Genesis 11, Abraham was simply called out. In Genesis 12, the promise of a seed was made to him. Now, in Genesis 13, 14-17, he is promised a land. All the points of the compass of that land will be his. Abraham pitches his tent today in Hebron. That means fellowship, because he's back in communion with God, and the blessing of God is upon him. And it's here, significantly in the place of fellowship, Hebron, that this patriarch settles immediately after his full surrender to God. Now we have the sixth component of that call, which is a victorious path after the call. Full surrender to God, fellowship with him, brings victory. Now we'll talk about this a little later on, but Genesis 14 describes the victory that Abraham had over four mighty kings that came from the east of the Euphrates. This victorious path brought Abraham face to face with Melchizedek, the king of Salem, priest of the Most High God. We read of that in Genesis 14, verses 18-20. And that Melchizedek is a most wonderful type, a picture of the Lord Jesus Christ, if not actually a pre-incarnation appearance of the Son of God. And you can check out Psalm 110, verse 4, and Hebrews 7 on this particular one. So we've examined the first main crisis in the life of Abraham, the call. Then we come to part number two, the covenant. And we're in Genesis 15 through to Genesis chapter 21 at this. Think firstly of the substance of this covenant. Genesis 15, verses 1 to 5. For protection and for deliverance, God promised he would be a shield unto Abraham. For provision and for blessing for Abraham, God says, I will be your exceeding great reward. What could be better than this? Contrast that with Genesis 14, verses 21 to 24, when he didn't have these benefits and boons in his life. To address Abraham's greatest problem, he was now 85 years of age and he was still childless. Well, how would he ever become a great nation if he had no offspring, if he had no child? To address that problem, that big issue in his life, God pledges, I will provide you with a son. You know, the further you go with God, the fuller the blessing will become. At the beginning, Abraham received no promise in Ur of the Chaldees. Then there was a promise of a seed, Genesis chapter 12, followed by the promise of a sphere, an area where you will live and your family will live after you, Genesis 13. And now he has the promise, the ultimate promise, of a son that would secure his future and his family's future and the nation's future, Genesis 15. So the promise is expanding. We've got not only the substance of it, but the seal and assurance of it. Genesis 15, verse 8 through to verse 13. This is very interesting, I feel. When covenants were made back in these days, they were validated and affirmed by the death of an animal. If the covenant would have been sufficiently important, then a number of animals would have been sacrificed. A big, important, vital covenant would have had a number of animals sacrificed, not just one. Genesis 15, verse 8 records Abraham's query to God when the Lord revealed the nature of the covenant, and he said, Lord God, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it? And God brings himself away down to Abraham's level here to make a special covenant with Abraham that he would understand, that would give assurance to his mind and added faith to his heart. In those days, when a covenant was made, the animal would have been divided in half. And the two parties entering into the covenant would have passed between the divided sections of the animal. And as they passed through the divided sections of the animal, one party was saying to the other party, if you fail to keep your side of the deal, your part of the covenant, may what has happened to this animal, in that it's been divided in two, happen to you. God instructs Abraham, you'll notice it here in Genesis 15, to verse 10, to divide the animals. Now listen to this. Had God and Abraham walked through this divided sacrifice, these divided animals, together, it would have been a bilateral covenant. The fulfillment of the covenant would have depended on both parties, God and Abraham, living up to their respective responsibilities. That would have been a tragedy here, for man has always failed. Since Adam in the Garden of Eden, sin turned away from God, became disobedient, man has always failed to fulfill the requirements that God has put upon him and failed to perform the will of God. However, here, when the time for walking through the covenant came, walking through these divided animals, when that time came, a deep sleep fell upon Abraham. The symbol of God in the form of a smoking furnace passed between the divided sacrifice, so God walked through by himself. Abraham did not. That made it not a bilateral covenant, but a unilateral covenant, and it signified that the responsibility for fulfilling these promises to Abraham's people, to the land that his seed would possess after him, the responsibility to hold up the covenant rested entirely with God. He made the promise. He passed through the pieces. He takes the responsibility for its fulfillment. He gave the promised seed, and God takes all the glory. This is the substance of it, the seal, and the assurance of it. It is a special covenant. Look thirdly at the scope of it. We read about that in Genesis 15, verses 13 to 21. The scope of the covenant, how wide was it? Well, it embraced the whole of Israel's history up to the time of their captivity. And so when God gives out the terms of the covenant here, he talks about the Egyptian bondage. That would happen many hundreds of years later. Verse 13, he talks about that. He talks about the Exodus and the wilderness wanderings in verse 14. He talks about the possession of the land of Canaan in verses 18 to 21. What a scope to the covenant God brings to bear upon Abraham's life at this time. Then we talk fourthly about the reception of it in Genesis 15 to verse 6. And he believed in the Lord. That's Abraham we're talking about there. And he believed in the Lord, and he that is God counted it to him, Abraham, for righteousness. You know what? We've just come across in Genesis 15 and 6, one of the greatest verses in all of the Bible, one of its foundation stones, one of its seed plots, one of its well-watered gardens. Out of these 14 words, and he believed in the Lord, and he counted it to him for righteousness. Out of these 14 words, three key ones occur in the Bible for the first time. And they immediately pass into the realm of great biblical theology. They are the words, believed, counted, righteousness. And in those three words, believed, counted, righteousness, we have the system of saving faith. What a systematic theology we have squeezed into Genesis chapter 15 verse 1. Then we have the compromise of this covenant in Genesis chapter 16. Abraham formed the opinion when some years had passed and still there was no son, no sign of a son, and it didn't look as if Sarah was ever going to be able to conceive. She was past the time when she could rightly have been expected to conceive. Abraham formed the opinion he could help God to fulfill this covenant. And that act proved his downfall. Even though God had promised, Abraham, I'll give you a seed and a land. Genesis 16 chronicles a tragic episode in Abraham's life because he takes Hagar, Sarah's handmaid, for the purpose of producing a male heir. It was a lapse of faith or an act of ignorance. But either way, Ishmael was produced through this union between Abraham and Hagar, and he was born in the manner of this Ishmael character that was not in accordance with God's plan. Due to the fact that Abraham had tried to fulfill God's covenant through the energy of his flesh, we have 13 years of silence that now ensue. Between Genesis 16, verse 16, and Genesis 17 and 1, there are 13 silent years. God is not communicating with Abraham. W.G. Scroggie says, fleshly haste frustrates its own end and postpones promised blessing. But God, ever gracious, gives, number 6 here, a further confirmation of the covenant in Genesis chapter 17. At the age of 99, God reaffirms to Abraham that his covenant with him will still be fulfilled. Genesis 17 verses 1 and 2. And it will be fulfilled in an exceeding and an everlasting fashion. What grace this is. Genesis 17 verse 2, verse 6, verse 7, verse 8, and verse 19. An exceeding everlasting fulfillment. Abram's name is changed here at this point to Abraham, meaning father of a great multitude. That's saying, Abraham, the promise that you're going to expand into a great people, that you'll have a great land in which to house these people. Well, now his very name is saying, I'm going to do it for you. So from Abram we come to Abraham, father of a great multitude. Sarai's is changed to Sarah, meaning a prince. Chapter 17, verses 5 and 15. Now, commenting on the changing of Abram to Abraham, Donald Gray Barnhouse has said, in Hebrew, God added one letter to Abram's name. And the letter that he added is the letter that's formed by breathing. In Hebrew, the name Jehovah is formed by five vowels, I, E, O, U, and A, with a twice repeated H. The word for spirit, which means breath, is ruach in Hebrew, which is pronounced by expelling air. God was adding his name to that of Abraham. And that's an important thing here. He's saying, I'm right on your side. I'm with you all the way. I'm even putting myself into your name. So definite this promise is. God reveals himself to Abraham using the name the Almighty God, El Shaddai. Genesis 17, the verse 1. John Phillips has defined the name as follows. He is the strong one. In the sense conveyed by the word Shaddai, the breast, the common Old Testament word for a woman's breast, God is Shaddai because he nourishes, he gives strength, he satisfies, he pours himself into the life of the believer. He is God, all-sufficient. And Abraham was going to need that kind of God. While the covenant of God would be established with Abraham through Isaac, Genesis 17, verses 19 and 21, Ishmael would also be blessed by God, according to Abraham's desire and his prayer in chapter 17, verse 18, and chapter 17, verse 20. However, the blessing that would fall upon Ishmael, it would carry a heavy price for Abraham's descendants. Disobedience and sin always carries a heavy price. Again, Donald Gray Barnhouse says, the blessing of Ishmael has carried with it the most terrible results of the centuries. Out of Ishmael came two horrible things, both of them great hindrances to the people of God. For out of Ishmael came the Arab race, which today bars the advance of Israel, the rightful owner of the land which God swore should belong to Isaac and to his descendants. And from Ishmael came Islam, which is the strongest threat to the advance of Christianity the world has ever seen. And if those words were relevant, back at the beginning of the 20th century when Barnhouse was writing them, they are even more relevant now at the beginning of the 21st century when Islam, in all of its militancy and might, is showing itself to the world and proving Israel we are out to get. Israel, we want to trample under our feet. And anybody who runs to the support of Israel, gets in our way, the way of our scheme and our plan, they will feel the lash of our terrorism too. It all stems back to this portion of Genesis. That's why we have the book of beginnings, the book of origins. You can trace all the lines back to here. There is nothing in the world today new under the sun. Now we have a summary of Genesis, the final chapters in the lead up to the cross in Abraham's life. That's Genesis 22, but we have to look at Genesis 18, 19, 20, 21. Genesis 18, what do we have? Three visitors that are welcomed there, including the Lord himself, and Abraham's intercession for Sodom we have in Genesis 18. In Genesis 19, Sodom is destroyed, Lot and his daughters are saved, the origin of Moab and Ammon is brought to our attention, tribes that later were to prove a constant snare to the nation of Israel. Check it out in Numbers chapter 25. In Genesis chapter 20, Abraham and King Abimelech, an old sin of Abraham's, resurfaces in his life. How sin had that terrible habit. We think, like the little child's play machine, you get the mallet and the hammer and you thump something down and down that thing goes, something else pops up, and then when you thump that down, the first one is back up again. The old sin resurfaces, and so it does with Abraham in chapter 20. Genesis 21, Isaac is born. Hagar and Ishmael leave. Sarah's demand that Hagar and Ishmael should be sent away, they run counter to the custom of the day. Abraham needs a word from God before he's willing to agree to what Sarah is demanding. And if you check it out by a study of Galatians 4, the verse 24 and following, it'll show that this rift was actually inevitable. So we've come through two great crises in Abraham's life. We've got his call, we've got his covenant, and now we have the cross in Genesis 22. And what a chapter this is. Abraham and Sarah waited for 25 years before the promise of a son was fulfilled. Now comes the ultimate test. And test is the meaning of the word tempt that occurs in Genesis 22 and verse 1. God is putting Abraham to the test here. He's not coming and tempting him like you do a dog and you put something in front of it, a bone for example, and you snatch it away when the dog goes for it, put it down, snatch it away, keep doing it. God wasn't tempting Abraham in that sense. The word tempt means test. He was putting him to the test, and here is the ultimate test in Genesis 22. Look at the terms of the command in verses 1 and 2. take an offer for a burnt offering. That is what he should do. Whom? Thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest. When? Do it now. Where? On Mount Moriah. Now this was a journey from where Abraham was, about 50 miles. It took 3 days, as verse 4 informs us. Mount Moriah was one of the hills on which the city of Jerusalem now stands, possibly even the Temple Hill itself. Confirm with 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and verse 1 on that one. Those are the terms of this command leading to the cross. Then we have the measure of Abraham's obedience. Genesis 22 and verse 3 makes it clear that Abraham's obedience was absolute again. All God commanded, he did. Then we have, because of that obedience, the secret of victory. Abraham believed and he obeyed God. When he set out with Isaac for this Mount Moriah, he said to his young men, "Abide ye here with the ass, and I and the lad will go yonder and worship, and," notice these words, "come again to you." I and the lad will go yonder and worship and come again to you. I and the lad will be back, the two of us. Genesis 22 and 5. Now this proves that Abraham believed that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, as we're told in Hebrews 11 verse 19. Abraham went up the mountain that day, believing in a sacrifice, first of all, and in a resurrection, secondly. Now where can we go for a greater example of faith than this? We have fourthly the range of the blessing. Genesis 22, 15 to 19. Individually, in the family, nationally, universally, blessing is promised for all of these. Then we have the line of the promise in Genesis 22, verses 20 to 24. A genealogy is drawn up here. A family tree is given to introduce us to Rebekah, who along with Isaac was destined to perpetuate the chosen line. The story of how they were drawn together. A romantic story. If you want to read one, you'll find it in Genesis chapter 24. How Rebekah came to be Isaac's wife. But the family tree, we have it noted down there in the middle of page 12. And that'll show you all the connections, the ramifications, how they were related together here. With Terah at the top, then Abraham, Nahor, Haran, and so on down through the sons and the daughters in this family tree. We've come to Isaac. Second character. Abraham is the fullest treatment of the lot. I am going to be going through Isaac very quickly, and Jacob and Joseph very quickly as well. You'll be relieved to hear, but Isaac is number two, and he's the second father of promise. We're introduced to him, of course, in Genesis 21, Genesis 22, when he's taken as the potential lamb for the sacrifice. And then right through until Genesis 28, verse 9, we are reading about Isaac. Isaac becomes the second father of promise, as the fulfillment of Abraham's promises are passed down and through to him. Isaac witnesses several major miracles during his life. He lives in the land of Abraham. He becomes prosperous. He dies at an old age, having fathered two sons along the way, Esau and Jacob. Now, we're not given the impression that Isaac was standing there in the front rank of the biblical saints. We only once read of him building an altar. No tribute is paid to Isaac, either in Genesis or in all of the other parts of the Bible. However, Isaac stands before us as a picture of the promised Messiah, Jesus, in several important respects. How does he look like Jesus? How does he resemble Jesus? Well, we've got a box there on page 13, in which are 4 points about Isaac's likeness to Jesus. He was predicted long before he was born. He was supernaturally begotten. He was the only son in the sense that he was the only son of covenant. He was the sacrificial lamb. And it's in these facts and these features, rather than in his personal character, that we must look at the real value of the record of Isaac's life. Didn't I tell you that Isaac we would deal with very quickly? We have dealt with him. We move on to Jacob now. Character number 3. In the patriarch age, Jacob, father of the nation of Israel. Now you notice the difference in the descriptive titles that are given to these men, because when we were with Abraham, way back on page 3, we were saying Abraham is the father of the Hebrew people. Then we had Isaac, the second father of promise, and now we have Jacob, father of the nation of Israel. We're coming up the station here as far as the Hebrew people are concerned. He is the father of the nation of Israel. And we read of him, Jacob, in Genesis 25, verse 19 to 34, and then Genesis 27 through, right through to Genesis chapter 50. What is happening in his life? Well, the summary is this. The promises given to Abraham are passed through Isaac to Jacob, Isaac's youngest son. Jacob begins his life as a conniving scoundrel. However, after a series of miracles and other encounters with God, he is a changed individual. Jacob has 12 sons. The promises of Abraham are passed down to all of these 12 as a family. While Abraham, we have seen, is the father of the Hebrew people, Jacob is the father of the nation of Israel. Israelites, we now have the new name given to Jacob at the Jabbok. He is Israel. And each of his sons becomes the father of one of the 12 tribes that make up the nation of Israel. Now we can divide the life of Jacob into four parts. And we associate each part with a particular place. And there are two outstanding features in each of these four parts. We have, for example, him presented to us as the supplanter at Beersheba. Genesis 25 to Genesis 28. And the word Beersheba means the well of the oath, the promise. It's still alive through Jacob. But he's the supplanter here. Two prominent features, the birthright, chapter 25, 19 to 34, and the blessing, chapters 27 and 28, because the joint deceit of Rebekah and Jacob give rise to the determination, even the wrath of Esau, and eventually result in Jacob having to take to his heels and depart for Haran, the place that grandfather Abraham left. Jacob was now going back to for a time. The supplanter at Beersheba. Then we have him as the servant at Haran. Interestingly, Haran means very dry, parched. And he's there in the biblical record, Genesis 29 through to Genesis chapter 31. Two prominent facts that emerge in Jacob's life at Haran is that he's being deceived, chapter 29 through to chapter 30, verse 24, and then he himself is deceiving, chapter 30, 25 to 31. Jacob enters into a contract with Laban, but he was cheated in that contract. We have the list of his children in Genesis 29, 31, through to Genesis 30, verse 24. His cattle are mentioned, the charge that he had is mentioned, the covenant, all of these are mentioned in this section. Now we move from him being a supplanter at Beersheba, a servant at Haran, to a saint at Hebron. Things are getting brighter in Jacob's life. Genesis 32 through to Genesis chapter 45. Prominent among the facts presented about Jacob's life here are his discipleship, chapter 32 and 33, and his discipline, chapter 34 through to chapter 45. The high point of his discipleship was that famous occasion when he had a conflict at Peniel, when he wrestled with the angel of the Lord, chapter 32, verses 22 to 32. You see, where there is discipleship, a desire to go on with God, a desire to have blessing, there will always be discipline. And the discipline comes to Jacob in various ways. For example, a dishonor is done to Dinah, his sister, chapter 34. Rachel dies, and Isaac dies, chapter 35. Those are hard events for him. The supposed destruction of Joseph. You remember how Jacob, as an old man, feels that Joseph, being thrown into the pit, then delivered by his brothers into Egypt, he feels, oh, it's all over, Joseph is dead. Chapter 37, a hard hurdle again for Jacob to get over. There's the disgrace of Judah in chapter 38, and the departure of Benjamin in chapter 43. It's all discipline. And given the type of discipline that he was compelled to endure, it's hardly surprising that he feels and that he says in Genesis 42 and the verse 36, all these things are against me. Look at my life. It's caving in. It's falling down like a row of dominoes. One thing leads to another. It's all disaster. But what a delight it was for Jacob to later understand that instead of all of these things being against him, working to put him down, all of these things had rather been working together for good to lift him up. Without pain, he learned there is no gain. So he was the supplanter at Beersheba, the servant at Haran, the saint at Hebron, and Hebron, as we know, means fellowship, and now he's the seer in Egypt. And Egypt means the land of depression. That brings us to Genesis 48 and Genesis 49. And being the seer, the prophet in Egypt, he pronounces the prophetic blessing on the two sons of Joseph in chapter 48 and on the 12 sons or tribes in chapter 49. And that is the end of Jacob's life. So we've come now to the fourth main character in the patriarch age, which is Joseph, the leader in Egypt, Genesis 37 through to Genesis chapter 50. Abraham's promises are accepted most keenly by Jacob's 11th son, Joseph. Jacob's sons, you see, for the most part, have very little commitment to God's call on them as a nation. They sell Joseph as a slave, he's taken down to Egypt, but because of his righteousness, he rises to become a great leader there. During a severe famine, his family comes to Egypt for food. The family is now reunited with Joseph, and as a result, the family enjoys peace and relative comfort. However, when Joseph dies, the fate of the Israelites takes a dying turn. His people are enslaved for the next 400 years, and this time of trial sharpens the spiritual hunger of the Hebrew people, and they cry out from their Egyptian bondage unto God for deliverance. Quite a sizable part of the book of Genesis is given over to the story of Joseph. This is for a number of reasons. While Joseph was not one of the three covenant heads of Israel, he was not Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, rather the son of Jacob. While he was not one of those main three, he is the link between Canaan and Egypt and between the story of Genesis and Exodus. Genesis 50 verse 26 and Exodus 1 verse 6. But in addition to him being the link between the two places and the two books and this history, Joseph gives probably the most perfect, the fullest type in all of the Bible, the best picture, photograph of Jesus we have. He is one of the few men without a but in his life. His life being an outline in the following manner: Joseph the son, Joseph the slave, Joseph the sovereign. And all of this points us to Jesus, the beloved Son of God, who became a born slave, and who out of his great humiliation was lifted up and exalted unto the throne. Philippians chapter 2. The parallels between Joseph and Jesus are many. And we list them here at the end of page 15 and right through to the top of page 16. We'll not give the references here as we read the points out, but you have them there in the notes. The beloved son. Here's how Joseph is like Jesus, the beloved son. Hated of his brethren. His words were not believed. His kingship was rejected. The conspiracy that was against him. He was stripped. He was tempted, but he didn't yield. Two others were bound with him. The one was saved, the other was destroyed. That's the butler and the baker, of course. He was without sin. He was released by the king. In him was found perfect wisdom. All power was given to him. He was made known through an interpreter. He became the salvation of his people by providing corn for them in Egypt. He married a Gentile bride, just as Jesus married us, the church. God gave him sons, which caused him to forget all the sorrow of the past. All was of God. Wonderfully full picture of Jesus, this Joseph is. Now this tremendous book of Genesis, that covers a history of approximately 2,400 years, begins with the power of God demonstrated in creation. He speaks, and the substance is there. It ends, this same book of Genesis, with a great mourning because of the deaths of Jacob and Joseph. It closes with the words, "A coffin in Egypt." And that reminds us, when we're brought to look into a coffin at the end of this book of beginnings, it reminds us of the portion of man as a result of his sin. He dies. The redeeming factor is that this is only the end of Genesis, not the end of the Bible record, salvation, already promised, Genesis 3 and the verse 15, already foreshadowed in those animals in Genesis 3, in Isaac in Genesis 22, that salvation foreshadowed, it is still to come. Christ will arrive.